try to cover a few different parts of the Sedra. Avraham Avinu sends Eliezer to find a wife for Yitzchak from his family and not from the people around him. Why? His family doesn't seem to be any great shakes that, you know, he'd want to marry somebody from that family. So there are many, many reasons given in the Rishonim, Achronim. I mentioned some of them. Rashi brings down that there was a curse on Canaan. So the people he lived amongst were cursed, and they had this stigma to them, and the people in his family didn't have that curse. They came from a different family, obviously. And therefore, Avraham Avinu said, I was blessed and these people were cursed. And even though there may be very fine people amongst them, but there's a certain stigma that these two things can't go together. That's Rashi. Others say that it was more of a practical thing. Avraham Avinu wanted to make sure that his daughter-in-law came from far away. Why? That Yitzchak Avinu, first of all, didn't go there. She had to come to him. And if the in-laws lived close by, then they would have a influence over the couple. And Avraham Avinu couldn't control that. Masha'en came, the daughter-in-law that he'd bring into his home, he could influence her. So to make sure that the in-laws were far away, he sent to his family, not specific to his family, but far away, not from close up. Rav Shamshon Falhurst has an interesting idea. He says that no one in the world was on the level of being fit to be Yitzchak's bride. It had to be somebody who had potential, they would bring out that potential and teach her and influence her and whatever. So if somebody in the world has to be influenced, taught, right, shouldn't it be from his own family? Right? A person, if he's going to influence somebody, mibsor chal tisalim. If you have to give tzedakah, give to your family first. So if you have to give spiritual benefit to somebody, give it to your family first. That's what he says, even though the truth is that it works just the opposite. The hardest people to have influence on is your own family. Right? Avraham Avinu had hashpa on everybody in the world except for Lot and Yishmael. They were his family. There he wasn't so successful. Which brings me to the main idea that... one other idea they say is that if the girl came from Canaan, then later generations would say, you know why we have the land of Israel? Because we inherited it from the mother's side. From whoever Yitzchak married. So in order to make sure that that's not the case, that everyone knows they got Eretz Yisrael because the Rabban Shem promised it to Avraham Avinu, not because they inherited from the mother's Yerusha who came from Canaan, therefore Avraham didn't want a daughter-in-law from Canaan. The Ran, which is the main reason I brought this up, says what seems to be on the surface very interesting idea, but doesn't seem to fit the issue at hand. He says like this. He says there are two kinds of distortions that a person can have. One is a distortion in deos, in ideas, philosophy, intellect, and the other is a distortion in midos, in character. He said intellectual kinds of things, like people who serve idolatry or whatever, that isn't handed down necessarily by spiritual heredity. But that's more something that people get intellectually. So you can retrain somebody to think differently. Masha'en came something that is bad character that could be transmitted from one generation to the other. And therefore Avraham was afraid. He said that the Canaanim had bad character. They had midos roles. And he was afraid that he would find a fine girl, but in the next generation or whatever, those bad character traits would surface. By her, it was a recessive trait. It would become a dominant trait in the future generation. But his family, even though they were over there with Zara, They were idol worshippers, but it was only the idea of intellect, intellectual corruption. And that wasn't handed down by, and if he could retrain and re-educate the girl who had potential, there wasn't a danger for future generations. That's what he says. Very nice idea. There's only one problem. Who are we talking about? Lavan and Besuel. These were people with exemplary midos, except they were over there by the Zorah. What does it mean? What does it mean? So at some point in the past, I wanted to say there are two ways that a person can have bad midos. One is that it's a result of his intellect. He was trained to a certain philosophy, and that philosophy entailed corrupt midos. So his midos are a result of his intellect. And sometimes it's the opposite. The character is innate. The person is corrupt in his, not because he believes in something different and follows that belief system. He's just a corrupt person. So that's what the Ran means. That Lavan and Besuel may have been corrupt midos-wise, but it came from their beliefs. They believe this is the way you're supposed to act. That doesn't pass on. But the other ones, the Kenanim, almost what it says, Rashi says, they were cursed, meaning there was something, a stigma in their innate behavior. Okay, but after that I have a different idea, which I think is more true. And the only problem is, today I saw again the Ran inside, and I'm not sure 100% if it fits in with his words. So if it's not, then it's my idea, and we'll leave the Ran with the answer that's in there. And that's the following. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says the following. He says, we normally think that a ganav is somebody who's stolen. He's a thief. Somebody who's never stolen is not a ganav. He says, it's not 100% true. He says, what would be if a person would be in a situation where he could steal and there'd be no repercussions? Example, you're in a room alone with a multi-millionaire who is senile, doesn't remember anything. He has loads of money. He came with a $10,000 package of small change that he was going to use for his small change that day. If that money is lost to him, it means nothing. It's like somebody losing a few agurot. You're sitting at the table with him, and he gets up and walks out of the room and leaves. And he leaves the $10,000 on the table. Your children are starving. You need that money desperately. If you take it, you won't hurt this guy at all. He will never miss it. He'll never know. No one will ever know. You can get away with it with no fear of being exposed. Would you take the money? If you would, then you're basically a thief. What separates you between the person who's stolen and you? Circumstances. The circumstances that enabled that person to steal presented them, and the circumstances that would enable you to steal didn't present themselves yet. A person is fit to be called not a thief if there's no circumstance in the world that could make him steal. But if there is a circumstance, and potentially he's a thief, the only thing that's holding him back from stealing is circumstance. So therefore, if a person has not worked on his midos, he hasn't become in control of them, they're not really a mida. They're just behavior. But they're not really what your character is. Your character could be different than your behavior. You could have a very fine behavior because no circumstances ever arose to make you function differently. So you function nicely. Right? To bring this out, I wasn't planning to mention this, but I will. I may think we mentioned in the past, but it's good to remember. The Rabbeinu Yonah says on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, "If ain derech eretz, ain Torah." That if the person does not have derech eretz, he doesn't have good character, then he'll never have Torah. He says, "Lo yishkon haTorah laolam b'misha ain bo midos tovos." The Torah can never exist by someone who doesn't have good character. Now, on the surface, that seems too categorical, because unfortunately there are people with not good character who have Torah. So what do you say? Well, if they're not that bad, or they could be better, or whatever. But I think the Rabbeinu Yonah is saying something different completely. To understand it, I'm going to say the following. The Reb Simcha Zissel from Kelem once made the following statement. He said that Darwin proposed the theory of evolution, that human beings evolved from apes because he never saw a real human being. So he assumed that the animals that he saw walking on two legs came from other animals. If he had ever seen a real human being like my Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, he never would have made such a theory. It's impossible to believe that Yisrael Salanter came from an ape. Now, on the surface, very cute, but it doesn't seem to be realistic, because Darwin was not, you know, this caveman swinging from the trees, you know, with bananas in his hands and a mug of beer in the other hand, and his friends were all these degenerates. He was a very respectable, refined person, and his circle of friends were very refined, respectable people. How could Reb Simcha Zissel say that Darwin never saw a real human being? What does that mean? The way I like to understand it is the following. It's a famous maisa that was said about three different gedolim, about the Maral, Rabbi Yonason Apeshitz, and the Rambam, which has me believe that it never happened. And it's just a nice story. Doesn't make a difference, not Torah Sheval Peh, that had to happen. But a lot of stories that are said about a lot of different people probably never happened to any of them. The story goes like this. The Rambam had a debate with a philosopher. The philosopher said you could train an animal to go against its instincts. And the Rambam said you can't. So the philosopher said, give me 10 cats and I will train them to go against their instincts and prove you wrong. So they gave him the 10 cats. A few months pass by, the philosopher says, I want you to come to a banquet and I'll prove to you I've trained these cats to go against their instincts. So the philosopher comes with a little box, Rambam comes with a little box, the philosopher opens his box, takes out a bell, rings the bell, and the cats come out of the kitchen, dressed as waiters and waitresses, with a towel over one arm and a tray in the other arm, balanced perfectly, and they serve the entree. The philosopher turns to the Rambam, he says, I've trained these cats to go against all their instincts. They're walking on two legs, perfectly balanced, they can balance a tray, they can curtsy, they act like waiters and waitresses, they're not cats anymore. The Rambam says, interesting, but it's a long meal, let's see what happens. So they does it, rings his bell again, they serve the main course, finally comes time to dessert. This philosopher takes out his bell, rings the bell, meanwhile the Rambam takes out his box, opens it up and puts it on the floor. Within minutes, there's pandemonium in the hall. The trays and the dishes are being thrown all over the place, and the cats are down on all four, chasing the mice that the Rambam let loose. Says the Rambam to the philosopher, you can train a cat to think he's a waiter as much as you want, but let the first mouse go by, and the cat remembers he's a cat. You can't change his instincts. That is an animal. An animal is called a behemoth, says the Maral, bo ma. Whatever it is, it can't change. Shor ben yom o kori shor. A shor is born ashore, it dies ashore, never changes. Adam, on the other hand, in gematria is ma. What? You always have to ask what and where he is, because he's always changing. A human being can change. And some say that is what it means in Koheles, umosar ha adam in a behemoth ayin. What is the difference, the benefit of a human being over an animal? Ayin with an aleph, that a human being can say no. An animal follows its instincts, right? It sees something that it is delicious to eat, that it's drawn to. It doesn't start thinking, am I going to get a stomach ache? Maybe there's something better to eat. I don't want to get filled up. I don't want to be fleshik. Whatever it may be, the animal doesn't make those cheshbonos. It eats. It follows its instinct. A human being can say no. He can make cheshbonos if he wants to. So the difference between a human being and an animal is the ability for a human being to control his instincts. Totally. And that is what I think Reb Simcha Zissel meant. Reb Simcha Zissel meant that there's only a difference of degree between an animal and a human being that never worked on his midos as in total control. So it's possible to think that this animal, who was on a more elevated level, came from a different animal. They're the same type, just different in degree. But had he ever seen a real human being who can control his instincts totally, was in total control, then he never would have made that theory, because it's not degree, it's different types. And this type couldn't have come from that type. In this week's Sedra, the Darchei Musar, Rav Naiman, says that was what happened with Ephron Achiti. Ephron, in the beginning, magnanimously said, I want to give Avram a present, I want to give him this burial plot for free. And in the end, he ended up overcharging him. What happened? He said, what happened was a mouse went by. Ephron could act very refined as long as there weren't any mice for him to get down on all four and follow. And mice come in all sizes and shapes. For cats, it's a little furry creature with four legs. For human beings, the mouse may be money, maybe other temptations. A person can act very refined if they've never worked on their midos, where they're in control. A mido means a measure. You're in control. You know how to use it and measure it properly. So somebody who has never worked on his midos, but he can be very refined as long as the mouse doesn't go by. As soon as the mouse goes by for that person, he's down on all four chasing him. As soon as Avraham Avinu mentioned money, Ephron lost control. And he couldn't control himself anymore. And he had to run after that mouse called money until he overcharged Avraham Avinu. So that's what it means, the Rabbeinu Yonah. Lo yishkon ha-Torah la'olam. Doesn't mean the Torah can never exist by somebody who doesn't have midos tovos. But it means the Torah can't exist forever. That's what it means. It can exist temporarily until the first mouse goes by. If you haven't worked on your midos and you're not in control, then you can have Torah until the first mouse goes by and you're drawn on all four. It's only a person who's worked on himself and is in total control that in no situation would he be dragged down by a mouse. That kind of person is fit to be called not a thief and fit to have Torah. Otherwise the Torah will last temporarily, but it can't exist la'olam, it won't exist forever. And I think that's what the Ran meant. Just as you can work on your midos and acquire midos tovos, you can work on your midos and acquire midos rovs. You can acquire bad character. Somewhere in the middle is no character. Meaning, sometimes you act nicely because there's no reason not to, and you're refined. And sometimes you act corruptly because the mice came by and you're following your instincts. A person can act behavior-wise nicely or abhorrently, but not because he's in control, because he's not in control. Or a person can act nicely because he's in control, and controlling that nice behavior, and it's coming from control of midos. Or he can act abhorrently because he's in control and he is behaving according to his really, negative character. Those are the three possibilities. The Kananim worked on their midos for the bad. They inculcated within themselves bad character. How do I know? Because they did things that no normal person could do just because the mice ran by, just because nature made them do it, right? Or temptation made them do it. For instance, it says the Kananim, when their parents got old, so they would feed them to their dogs for two reasons. One is they were a burden, so they want to get rid of them. So do like other societies did, put them on a raft and, you know, let them go out to sea and die where you don't see them. No, but they also didn't want to waste a meal for their dogs. So they're getting rid of their parents, they might as well feed them to the dogs, save a meal. You don't do that because you're not in control and you just do what comes naturally. That does not come naturally to anyone in this world. No one. You have to really work on yourself to be able to control yourself to make your behavior that despicable. You have to work on yourself for that. Or they used to barbecue their children to their gods slowly over a fire, hand them to the priest handed them back and forth until the kid screaming, and that's why they called it gay hatufim. What does it say? The place where they sacrificed their children, they had drums. And the Abarbanel says the reason was because the kids would be screaming from pain. So they had to drown out the screaming. So they played drums at the time to drown out the kids' screaming. Now again, that's not doing what comes naturally. You have to really work on yourself to be able to do that to your children. So, even though sometimes remembering that, right, maybe not that difficult sometimes for some kids at some times. Okay, in any case, but you have to really work on your midos roles. The Knanim had bad midos, not that they just had bad behavior. Masha Enkein, Avram's family, they were not great people. And Lavan Ha'arami, he was a cheat. But it always says, Lavan Ha'arami Mipagan Aram, says the Kli Yoker, because the reason he was like that wasn't because he worked on himself to become a cheat and a charlatan, right? But because he lived amongst people like that. So he did what came naturally. That was the environmental influence. So the difference between Avram's family and the Canaanim was Taka in Mitos. But not bad behavior, what's it called, is passed on hereditarily, right? That doesn't, just because the father did something doesn't mean the kid's going to do that. But what a person inculcates into his character and it becomes what he really is, that could be passed on with spiritual heredity. So the Canaanim inculcated bad character into their essence. Avram was afraid that would pass on to future generations. His family had bad behavior, but they didn't inculcate that bad behavior into their characters innately, and therefore Avram wasn't afraid what would be in future generations. That, I think, was what the Ran means. Okay. Again, if you look at it, the words are hard to push into what he says, what I'm saying, but I'm going to look into it again and see if I can find a way to fetch it out. In any case, yeah, that's okay. See another thing. Eliezer, the way the Torah says it, he asked Rivka for a drink, so she offered him a drink. She said, "Shasei, drink." He drank. After he finished, she said, "Gam legamalecha eshav. Now I'll give for your camels." So what really happened was, she offered him a drink alone. He drank, and then she offered for the camels. The Beis Halevi says an interesting thing: why he did it like that. First, asked for a drink for himself, and then to see if she'd offer for the camels. It wasn't just to see if she was a kind person, but to see also if she was a person who did her kindness with chachma, knowing what the needs of that person are. You can be kind, but you're not really doing it because you put yourself in that other person's shoes. He said, what happens like this? Here she has this adult, she's like 3 years old, and this adult man, right, comes and says, could you give me a drink? Right? Now, Lamaisa, why can't he get a drink for himself? Right? He's like a mature man. Why can't he go and draw some water? So she said, either he's not so nice, okay, he's lazy, or maybe he's sick, and it's hard for him to bend down and to get the water. Okay, so she had that in her mind. Either he's not a nice guy, right? He's a lazy guy, or he's sick. So she gives him a drink of water. He drinks the water, and he leaves over some. Now she has a problem. If the guy's dumb, lazy, right, so I'll drink what's left over, because if I spill it out, I'm going to insult him. Why am I spilling out good water, right? On the other hand, if he's sick, and I drink what's left, maybe I'm going to catch what he has. So whatever I do, I'm going to insult him if I pour out the water, and I'm going to maybe make myself sick if I drink the water. So she came up with a great idea. I'll offer for his camels. But if I only give it what's left to the camel, he's going to figure out that I'm doing that to get rid of the water that he left over. So I'm going to have to offer for all his camels. And that's what she did. So it wasn't that she was a nice, kind lady who wanted to give his camels. It was because she really didn't want to insult him. On the other hand, she didn't want to get sick. So she did what was necessary in order to really do a kindness to this guy and not hurt his feelings either. Okay. So that's what happened. When Eliezer tells it over, he changes it. And he says, I asked her for a drink, and she said, Shesei, the gamlik malecha eshev. I'm going to give you a drink and also for your cattle. Before he drank anything. Why did he change it? Why didn't he say what happened? So I was thinking, the idea is the following. Eliezer wanted to bring across a point, and that is, your daughter, sister, is really a special person. Now, what is the hallmark of a special person according to the Torah, according to what's really right? Emor ma'at va'aseh harbeh. Promise a little and do a lot. Okay? Don't promise the world and then do nothing. Promise a little and then do more than you promise. That's the Torah way. That's how a tzaddik functions. A rasha, wicked people, function the other way. They promise you the world, and usually they end up not being able to do anything.
Like Ephraim.
Politicians, right, like Ephraim, exactly. Ephraim was the example, the Gemara of Ephraim is Emor Hardei Vafilu Ma'atin. He promised Avraham everything, giving the whole thing for free. In the end, he overcharged. So, the Shurei Das explains that this is not because Rishoyim are liars and they want you to think they're going to do a world for you and they really don't mean it. No, it's a different, it's a psychological thing. He says the reason is the following. Tzaddikim know that they have a Yetzer Hara. They're not in control of everything. There are circumstances that come up that they can control. There's the temptations of their Yetzer Hara. So they know that they're limited. So they can't promise you the world. They promise you a little bit. Because they anticipate the problems that they're going to have, they're able to overcome them. And they end up doing a lot. Rishoyim think they can do anything. They don't recognize they have a Yetzer Hara. They don't recognize that there's things that they can't deal with. So they promise you the world, thinking they can do it. But since they never anticipated any problems, the first little problem that comes by finishes them off. If you don't anticipate the problem, right? He says that's the meaning of a Gemara in Sukkah. The Gemara says in the future God's going to shech the Yetzer Hara, the Satan, and he's going to appear like a big mountain in front of the tzaddikim, and they're going to cry, how did we conquer this mountain? And he's going to appear like a hair's breadth to the Rishoyim, and they're going to cry, how did we not conquer this hair's breadth? He says what it means is the tzaddik always anticipated his Yetzer Hara. So he was able to conquer it one thing at a time. You anticipate problems, you're able to overcome them. So the Yetzer Hara became a big mountain for them, one after the other, and they constantly conquered it. The Rasha never anticipated any problems, never a Yetzer Hara. So the first little hair's breadth tripped them up. They never got past that. So to them, the Yetzer Hara was just a hair's breadth, and to the Tzaddikim was a mountain. And therefore, Eliezer wanted to impress upon these two Rishoyim, Lovin and Besuel, that the sister and daughter was really special. What's special to a tzaddik? That you promise a little and you give a lot. That's what she did. But if he would have said that to these two Rishoyim, their psychology is, promise the world. Why'd you only promise, why did you only say give them a drink? You should have promised them everything. Right? What kind of great person are you? So, in order to get across the message to them, he had to change it. I always compare it to the following. We know that there's dyslexia. You see things backwards. I want to make up a disease I don't think exists called verbal dyslexia, oral dyslexia. That when somebody says yes, you hear no. When they say no, you hear yes. I think some of my kids had that when they were growing up. And somebody like that, you know this person has that disease. So when you say yes, he hears no. When you say no, he hears yes. And he says to you, is it nighttime now? What do you have to answer him? No. Why? Because you know that he hears yes. So that's not lying. It's just adapting the truth to how he can hear it. He can't hear it any other way. Okay? This famous mice in the Gemara with Rava and Rabchia, his son. Rava had a wife who for some reason was very difficult for him. And one of the things she did was whenever he asked for breakfast for eggs, she gave him cereal. And when he asked for cereal, she gave him eggs. Very contrary woman. Doesn't say why that was. That's who she was. So Rava never bothered. He took whatever he got. He asked for eggs. He gave him cereal. He ate the cereal. This went on until his son Chia became mature. He once said to his son Chia, "Tell your mother I want cereal for breakfast." So Chia wasn't stupid. And he said, "I know every time he says cereal, he gets eggs." So he goes to his mother and he says, "Dad wants eggs for breakfast." "Eggs? Fine." She gave him cereal. First time in his life he got cereal when he asked for cereal. He said, "Is your mother okay?" So he said, "Yeah, I told her eggs." He said, "You're smarter than I am, but don't do that because you're going to learn how to lie." Now, even though in that circumstance what I'm saying is 100% the truth, he knew that in order for his mother to give cereal, he had to say eggs, right? But a kid shouldn't do that, because then you learn how to lie. But the emes is, that's emes. Saying no to the person who has that disease when he asks you if it's night means you're saying yes in his ears. Therefore, Eliezer had to impress them upon them that Rivka was something special. If he were to say what happened, that she said a little and did a lot, they see that as something negative. So he had to say it in their terms. "No, she promised me the world. In your terms, that's greatness. In what really happened, the greatness was the other way. But in order for you to hear it, I have to say it your way. I have to say it the way you hear it." Right. It only works. Even according to Beis Halevi, it could be that first she gave him, and he drank a little bit, but she already anticipated what's going to be if he left over. The Beis Halevi works better according to the way it says. Right? But that she only promised him a little bit, he drank, left over, and whatever. Doesn't work if you hold that he gave everything in the beginning. But according to the way Torah says, that's the way it happened. So that's the way you can say it.